Yeah, I think it hasn't died because I think there's like this secret unconscious punk desire to make sure that there's still art here.
Oh, my friend, it's jealousy in the green. I monster life's 2 feet, and I don't know if I'll ever get there. I seem to always judge and compare. They seem to haunt me. Oh, they must mean something right. I could say those were the best days, but that would be such a lie.
Thank you so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded, ancestral, traditional, and shared territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations in the city colonially known as Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, to hear Time Not Wasted, a radio documentary looking back at 30 years of Music Waste Festival. This is part two, The Secret Unconscious Punk Desire. I'm Dora Duber, and you just heard the song Green by Cool TV off of their 2014 album, Paint. This episode is going to go over the more recent history of Music Waste Festival, where it's at now, the changes it's made in the past few years, and how those changes came to be. But before we get into all that, let's recap part one really quickly. In case you didn't know, Music Waste is a festival that has music, art, and sometimes comedy. It's politically engaged, it has no money, and 2024 is its 30th year of running in Vancouver. Music Waste started as a one-night show, kind of protesting, kind of poking fun at Music West Festival, which was a big industry-focused festival that ran in Vancouver for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s. Music Waste was kind of finding itself as a festival for the first few years until it was taken up by Terminal City Magazine, and eventually Only Magazine, to become the festival that we know and love today. Which is a bunch of alternative independent shows, music, art, and or comedy, at venues all over East Vancouver over a whirlwind weekend in, now, June. put on by a small group of volunteers who, kind of necessarily, put their whole hearts into the festival. It oversaw the music scene in Vancouver completely transform as venues began shutting down and the city became increasingly unlivable for artists. Over that time, it also gained a bit of a reputation for being cliquey, snarky, and even a little mean. As the age of irony ended, and we, more or less, entered a resurgence of earnestness, Music Waste began the slow process of rehabilitating its softly bruised image. That's just a brief little kiss of an overview. Obviously, I recommend listening to the whole first part to get all of the nuances, etc. of what we're discussed, but that'll get you where you need to be. The main focus of this episode is the ways Music Waste has changed and how essential those changes were. Let's start with the basics. What has been Music Waste's role in Vancouver's music scene?
The intention was to not take ourselves too seriously and was just to like provide bands the opportunity to express themselves and to play without having to pay to play or without having to do a ton of work themselves and to maybe, you know, find some new audience without it being super commercial. So just to like connect with a wide variety and have it be just like fun and not serious and not trying to like sell yourself, but rather trying to connect.
To me, Music Waste means it's all about community. It's all about that kind of DIY community aspect. It's the music community both giving back to bands and bands giving to the music community. It leads into the mission, which during my time there, I felt was it created a low cost, accessible way for folks who might not be super involved in the Vancouver music scene to see, at the time, over 100 bands in a weekend for $15. Just an incredible opportunity.
Okay, so part of the mission of the Festival of Music Waste is to put on a festival that, like, I think feels sort of equally good for the bands and the people attending, and that is like accessible for everyone, which I think is cool. Like, part of the mission, this is like a weird way to put it, I guess, but part of the mission of Music Waste has always been to pay bands. I mean, that's like how it started, right? As a reaction to a festival that made you pay to submit and then you might not get into it. And Music Waste model has always been a profit share model. And it's meant to, I think, sort of try to equalize things a little bit. Like, we've never, you know, there aren't headliners. Every band gets paid the same. This might be your 100th show or it might be your first show. And you might be like sharing a stage with those bands and everyone's paid the same amount to get into those shows. And it's a really great opportunity to sort of like, if you're not a musician, you will probably meet a lot of people who are in bands or performing. And that sort of builds community a bit in that way, because people get to know each other and it creates this thing that sort of like feels cohesive.
An event that is focused on like being a chill time. Like, everything about Music Waste is accessible. And I think that's really important to me, as someone who just like finds barriers and strange things. I find that Music Waste is like not only dirt cheap to see like so many bands, but yeah, it's like a really easy way to like meet people, to like find new music. Yeah, it's not pretentious, it's not clicky. We bring in so many different genres too, which I think is rare. So we get to like meet people we normally would never have met. So I think Music Waste is just like very for the people, by the people.
It's cool as fuck. It's so fun. It is so rooted in community, which I really deeply appreciate, at least from what I've experienced. Obviously, I'm sure that it's morphed and changed and has gotten to the place that it's gotten to with time and love and care from so many other people and so many positive necessary changes being made along the way. And there's still so much room for that, but it's like a growing baby. Like, I feel like it's like an adolescent that's that's like learning empathy. And I think that's its place in the music scene generally, just because a lot of other spaces in the music scene, I feel like, are like bratty toddlers. Like they're in their terrible twos. They don't really care. But Music Waste does care and is trying, which is great.
So, community, accessibility, and reciprocity. Finding new music, meeting new people, not being pretentious, removing barriers for all members of Vancouver's music community in as many ways as possible. From the perspective of at least all the people I talk to putting on Music Waste between the early 2000s and today, all of these are constants in the festival's mission. But even in those short clips, you can really hear how the way they talk about it has changed.
Fundamentally, the mission is the same. I think maybe what has changed over time a little bit has been the values, if it makes sense to make that distinction.
That's Natalie Corbo, who has been an organizer at Music Waste since 2016-ish.
I'm Natalie Corbo, and I started volunteering with Music Waste in 2016, I think, 2016 or 2017. And I had been going to Music Waste since, I don't know, 2011 or 2012. And I thought it was the funnest thing in Vancouver, like by far. And then I moved to Toronto for a little bit and actually came back 1 year for Music Waste. And yeah, when I moved back, they like needed more people. And so I was like, oh, amazing. I can do this. I can make new friends in Vancouver again and be a part of this thing that I really love. Yeah. And I think, you know, Music Waste, like as an entity that like aims to be inclusive and that aims to create safer spaces, that's different. That's new. I know that's new.
Yeah.
That's evolved since I've been involved with it. Right. So
we're going to hear about how the festival's priorities shifted throughout this episode. But I just want to highlight Natalie's, in my opinion, really perfect framing of a lot of the changes that Music Waste has undergone in the past few years. We talked about this a bit in part one, where the festival's focus shifted from the industry to the performers. Now, you could argue that the focus is on the scene or the culture of nightlife and what it means to put on music shows for as wide an audience as possible. Music Waste is a pretty unique project in art spaces generally. It's been running for 30 years, which is a pretty long time for something of its size and capacity, but it's mostly put on by volunteers. There are a lot of reasons as to why this is special. To quickly name a few, it's a lot of work, and the people involved are not experts by any means. More often than not, they're random, arts-adjacent anti-capitalists who, for whatever reason, have a lot of free time. Call it the snowflake left or whatever. But as language and identities and conformities have morphed in the larger culture, the people who fuel Music Waste have always been ahead of wherever they've been on the curve. So as the curve shifts, so does the festival. Music Waste's transformation over its 30 years have kind of been an archive of the discourse in Vancouver's music scene and the culture more generally. So why have these things, community, accessibility, and reciprocity, always been seen as so essential? Well, the main things that come up in these conversations with organizers have been how hostile the city is towards the arts, the general culture of coldness in Vancouver, and just how tough it is to put on a full festival as a small group of volunteers. But before we can really get into these trends, we have to look at how Music Waste has and hasn't grown. While it's true that Music Waste has objectively changed a lot throughout its tenure in Vancouver, a lot of its changes have been slow, small, and internal. Like Natalie said, it's favored value shifts over landmark changes.
During my time in the fest, I definitely noticed big changes in the size of the festival as a whole.
That's Dustin Bromley, who is an organizer and eventually festival director at Music Waste throughout the 2010s.
We kind of hit a peak. If I was to throw out a year, I would probably say around 2011 or 2012 in number of bands and volume of attendees, volume of venues. I feel around 2011, again, don't quote me on the exact year, but was just a pinnacle of size. And there was conversations we had with some folks that were interested in kind of taking it a step bigger or making it a Pop Montreal or making it a Sled Island kind of thing. And we definitely pushed back against that. We wanted to stick true to the roots of the festival. And you know, the festival's always been supported by itself. It's always been DIY. It's never been accepting outside sponsorships and stuff. For Music Waste, it's supported by itself and the bands and the volunteers. And we wanted to keep it that way. So we definitely saw kind of a future where the trajectory could keep growing in that way, but like it would require a pretty big financial influx. And we didn't want to make that change. So over the next couple of years, practically, we had to shrink it a little bit. We couldn't have 140 bands over a weekend anymore. So when I left, I feel like it was down to around 80 or so. And the number of venues we had to really tighten up on because, like I mentioned earlier, we were paying more venue fees and such. So I did see over my time there, I did see like a pretty good curve going up to around 2011, and then kind of the size shrunk a bit, which was it was a little upsetting. It was tough. It was tough to not equate success to size.
Managing the size of the festival alongside rising venue costs and staying true to the core mission is something that Music Waste continues to struggle with today. But the main force limiting what some might describe as the festival's potential is honestly the organizer's capacity.
There's this interesting thing that happens with Music Waste, which is that it is a ton of work to put on this festival, and the festival is organized entirely by volunteers. And so a lot of those volunteers have really like a ton of enthusiasm and really incredible ideas for what we could do differently in future years or like new initiatives. And there's like always a lot of ambition, but then that always sort of comes up against the reality of it's just a ton of work to put on this festival. And so there's like a certain amount of, I don't know, inertia or something that happens where you just get so consumed by trying to keep up with like the bare bones of putting on this festival that even though we've definitely like evolved and tried new things, often like our ambitions have to get like scaled down a little bit because it is just so much work to do the thing as it's always been done, like much less like trying to do something completely different.
So Dustin touched on this a bit with the Music Waste being sustained by itself, the band, and its volunteers. But how does Music Waste money work?
We basically, like, we make enough money each year to cover our costs and pay the bands an amount that feels acceptable. I think, like, it is changing a little bit because everything is so expensive now that it's like it's not like Music Waste costs have gone up that much, but like just like whatever amount of money you pay people feels like more pathetic now, unfortunately. But yeah, we are able to do it and sustain the festival year over year without outside help, the exception being 2021 because we couldn't sell tickets or passes for the festival. And I think the thing that kind of concerns me about the idea of grants or sponsorships, like aside from, I think there's the sort of like political side of it of, you know, taking corporate money feels yucky. But there's of course the option of like when we did the sponsorships in 2021, we didn't get like corporate money. We got money generally from sort of local businesses and like Mint Records, frankly. So, you know, there's a way to do it that doesn't feel like gross or whatever. But yeah, and then on the grant side, I think if you're applying for and accepting grant money, there is an element of needing to make sure that you're in your grant applications, like your values align with the granting organization. And in some cases, like that might put you in a weird spot if your festival wants to like say something specific about, I don't know, like anything that could be considered like political or divisive. And I think Music Waste has always, or I don't know, well, always is a strong word, but we've generally been pretty, if we believe in something, we will like post about it on Facebook or we will host a fundraiser. And I think being beholden to a larger cultural institution or government or any of these types of things, especially in an environment where in the current municipal political climate, there's definitely been an attack on nonprofits and organizations operating in the city that do have like a political point of view that doesn't necessarily align with the mayor's office or that have critiqued the mayor. Yeah, I mean, even in a small way, you know, organizations have had their funding pulled, and that's really messed up. So there's all of those sort of like political or value risks associated with taking grant money or sponsorships. And then on a more practical level, it also just puts you in a position of uncertainty because you're having to each year, you know, apply for these grants, which you may or may not get. Because again, I don't know tons about like the grant process, but I feel like just doing the exact same thing every year, even if you're evolving in small ways, yeah, is not what these granting organizations want to see. They want to see you growing. They want to see you, you know, trying new things. And yeah, in terms of sponsorships, it's like, who knows? And I remember thinking about this when Folkfest was like, we have to, like, we can't do this anymore. Financially, it's not sustainable. This was like coming out of the pandemic. And I remember thinking like, oh, actually, it's really cool that Music Waves, we don't have any fixed costs. We don't, as an organization, have to pay like rent on a space. If the festival doesn't happen, we don't spend any money. And we have a good idea of how much it's going to cost each year. And our primary cost is paying bands. So if we feel like, you know, we're really tight for money, we can put on a smaller festival, and that reduces our like biggest cost. So I think just in terms of like being sustainable and like why Music Waves has lasted for 30 years, part of that is because we're able to just like keep doing this on our own, and reliance on outside financial help has not been a big part of that.
In continuing this conversation around staying true to the festival's anti-industry and anti-capitalist roots, what does that even look like in today's music industry?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that culturally we're in a different place than like the 90s or early 2000s in terms of how sponsorships are viewed. I think now it's sort of viewed as a little bit more of a necessary evil in a lot of cases, or like even an inevitability, whereas in, yeah, the 90s, like this idea of like, quote, selling out was like a really important thing that was like not punk, and you couldn't do it, and it was a really big deal, and you know, bands wouldn't like license their music to commercials and stuff like that. And now it's sort of like, well, there's just so little money for artists in the way that we've kind of set up like our economy and like the way that everything is streamed, and you know, it's so like, it's just so hard to make money as an artist now that I think those types of deals or sponsorships or whatever are just not viewed quite as negatively as they used to be, because people are like, well, you have to make money somehow, and it's really brutal. So do what you got to do a little bit.
Yeah.
You just heard Blackbird by Channel 3 and 4 off their 2006 album Desire. Channel 3 and 4 was Sarah Cordingley, a legendary Music Waves organizer, and others band. And she described them as having played 8 shows a month, all at different venues in the late 2000s, early 2010s, something that would be unheard of in Vancouver today. Venue shutdowns is an obvious contributor to that shift, but the vibe check is a little harder to pin down.
It was so long ago, it's like a little bit hard to remember. I remember when I started going, like, definitely it just felt like, even though it was really fun and people were nice to me, it did feel like intimidatingly cool. And there was definitely a little bit of an element of that. But then, yeah, in terms of how it's changed and how I've seen it change, especially since I've been involved, definitely like an explicit focus on sort of shedding that image a little bit of it being sort of exclusive and people feeling intimidated by, you know, Music Waste or what the festival is. And part of that has been around transparency, I guess, and like trying to just be more explicit with the audience and with bands about how everything works.
My name's Naomi. My pronouns are she, they. And I found out about Music Waste semi through CITR, just being around the station adjacently and then collaborative events that they'd done, like Vic Square. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I'd love to get involved. And I was looking for a way to integrate myself with the local music scene in Vancouver because I had moved here for university and didn't really know many people with common interest in that realm. And so I applied to be on the exec team, and now I've been on for a couple of years as an organizer.
Theirs is a quintessential Music Waste organizer story. A lot of the team is people who moved to Vancouver and wanted to find a way to get involved with the music scene. And she also volunteers at CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine. I don't want to talk about it too much, but there's a pretty long history of a CITR to Music Waste pipeline. The big three of Vancouver's DIY scene is Music Waste, CITR, and Mint Records. A Venn diagram that's very nearly a perfect circle of bands, initiatives, values, and often people.
I totally see why people think that. I mean, like, I literally worked at CITR, helped with Music Waste, and interned at Mint Records, and all around the same time. So
that's Eleanor Wearing, who was the festival director at Music Waste in the late 2010s.
I think that the ways that they are like intertwined in throughout time has really come down to like the people that are involved in all of them. And that they share like similar values and like hopes and dreams for the Vancouver music community, you know? So it's hard to find someone who's like a bigger champion, though like a very quiet champion of the music community in Vancouver than Randy Iwata, who is Mint Records, you know? So I think that like certainly in the years where you have multiple people working at CITR who also were running Music Waste, you're going to see a lot more like overlap of what's going on between them, you know, and a lot more like partnership, because that's just how like the arts world and the nonprofit world works, you know. And even if there was no one at CITR who was helping at Music Waste, the very mandate of CITR would be to promote and support an event like Music Waste and like the bands playing it. So I think they're just like mutually beneficial little parasites feeding off of each other.
CITR is also in a unique position where it's connected to a university and constantly has a group of young, eager, and excited volunteers. But this is all an aside. Back to Naomi and their experiences with getting involved at Music Waste.
When I was first learning about it, I had little to no exposure or opinion because I'd spent the summer before in Edmonton, so I wasn't around during the festival. I saw the lineup and I recognized some names and faces, just like the few shows that I'd been to or been exposed to in my first year in Vancouver. And I did know that there was some overlap with Music Waste people, or sorry, CITR people. I think like two people that were very friendly and bubbly and genuine was something that I had yet to have met in like music spaces that I also did find music spaces quite intimidating at the time. And I don't know what it was about music waste. I think I just found it a lot less intimidating. Mentorship is a great way to put it because that's exactly how I've felt up to this point. Like, I felt like my first year was kind of just like me learning the ropes, kind of getting comfortable in the group of people, especially because like I'm younger too. I was like, oh, still, like, it was definitely not intimidating in the sense of, oh, this is something that I cannot do. Like, I was like, oh, I can do this, but just like feeling comfortable in the space, like, and that's more of a me thing. Like, it wasn't like people were not facilitating that whatsoever because they 100% were. But now I feel like I've gained my footing a little bit more. And after going through one festival and being like, oh, okay, I have done things. Like, I feel like my spot in all of this is a lot more grounded, I guess.
This might seem like a really super random internal change, but I think that it is so fundamental to what I've been calling the lore of music waste. And it's not just a music waste problem, although it definitely is a product of this larger cultural attitude of gatekeeping music and its surrounding community based on literally nothing. Things that have nothing to do with interest in music, like gender, age, race, queerness, disability. The name three albums attitude that is so played out, but we're still feeling the reverberations of. And music waste is not perfect, but compared to the conversations that I had with older organizers and some people who maybe wanted to organize but never made the leap, Naomi's perspective is shockingly different and in such a positive way. The festival's internal shift is reflected in more forward-facing ways.
The larger listening committee was a new thing. I think the year that I started doing it, or maybe, yeah, I think the year that I started doing it. Previously, the whole curation process just was done by all of the folks on the organizing committee who would be like in a room doing the listening party. They would pick all the bands on one day and go through all the submissions. And that still happens. But the year that I started doing it, all of a sudden there was a larger group of kind of people involved in the music industry or the music scene behind the scenes who were also listening to the submissions and kind of helping the organizers figure out a little bit like what the broader audience was interested in, and then the organizers would sort of curate from there.
So not only is a listening party no longer an all-day drinking fest of elitist cheerleaders, to quote Mish Wei's 2013 Vice article, but it actively invites a broader group of people to give their input. I don't know if I've said this enough yet, but being on the organizing team is a lot of work. And picking the final lineup for the festival should have a lot of consideration and intention, which, again, just is a lot of work. And while everyone might want to be on the squad, it's just not realistic for everyone to be able to make the pep rally. If we're going to continue with the cheerleader metaphor. But that is just to say that it's a way for the festival to invite a bunch of different voices in without asking them to take on too much. And that's also exactly the attitude that led to the development of the Music Waste Community Council.
So the Community Council is a little group of former organizers and community members that don't necessarily need slash want the burden and like not burden, but the responsibility of like meeting and organizing the festival on a week-to-week basis. But they do care about the festival, and it's a way for the organizers to get a second set of eyes, second set of opinions on things that are happening, just like community consult essentially. So they're met with ideally 2 to 3 times a year, I think. Early stages of planning, right before the festival and then right after. And also if there's any incidents or things that might need a second opinion, they're also consulted.
The council started in 2019. I remember the original idea was that we would meet once a month and give updates and discuss changes and plans and evaluate the festival from top to bottom. But to go back to what Natalie said earlier, our ambitions had to be scaled down. Not only did the pandemic hit shortly after, but it was too much to expect a group of busy and respected members of Vancouver's music scene, who are invested in the festival, but obviously don't have the same level of buy-in as people who are meeting about the festival once a week, to give up so much of their time. So, as it's existed, the Community Council has constantly been negotiating its role in the festival and what makes sense for them. But this idea of buy-in comes up a lot when talking about music waste. In a lot of ways, music waste is able to continue because it has buy-in from the entire music community in Vancouver. Organizers have buy-in to put the festival on for free. The audience has buy-in to respect the bands and the people around them. Venues historically have buy-in to offer their spaces at a reduced price or for free. Bands have buy-in to be paid nominally, and all for a weekend-long fun fest. Time in the documentary where we dive into what it means to have volunteers run a full music festival in Vancouver in 2024. Vancouver is so specific, and the arts landscape is so different from when the festival started. But, like we were getting at earlier, Music Waste relies entirely on the people in Vancouver, artists, attendees, and organizers, to give up their time, care, energy, attention, and trust to the festival, with very few questions asked.
I think that the tension between making sacrifices in terms of like energy level and time to put something out is like, I don't know, you're always having to negotiate that. And you always have to negotiate that in art too, you know, where you're like, sometimes it doesn't matter. Like if a friend needs help with something, I love that. It's one of those weird things where like, yeah, you get really stressed out the week leading up to it. And like, you feel it taking a toll on your body, but I don't know. It's tough. Cause I don't want to like glamorize it, you know, because it's like when it comes together you're like, oh yeah, it was all worth it. Like, I don't know, maybe some of it was, definitely not all of it. I think each person has to do those negotiations themselves in terms of like how much they want to put into something versus how much they're getting out of it and what it means to like give back to the community, I guess. But also like, it's tough. There is an exploitative nature to it's like not even it's not maybe it's not necessarily exploitative, but it's like everyone agrees that some of it's going to be stressful and shit, and that it's going to take a bit of a toll. And whether, I don't know, whether that's good or not, I don't know. I think it's just like, that's where we're at in terms of like getting stuff done and things need to get done.
And at the end of the day, Aaron, who put on Comedy Waste in 2018 and is an active musician and comedian in Vancouver, is right. Things need to get done in order for the festival to run. But you have to find value in that to be motivated to be able to do those things. Lee Young, who is currently on the organizing committee and puts on Art Waste, had this to say.
Yeah, and I think like you don't even get to see the real value of doing something completely like out of pocket and like as a volunteer gig until it's over, until you're all done with it. And then you're like, holy shit, that was super rewarding. Like, holy shit, I have these experiences and memories I would not have gotten otherwise. But I still all the time get questioned why I do this, like if I drop that it's volunteer, that I'm doing it for free, people ask me why I do it. People not understanding why I could possibly want to spend my time and energy into something that will not reward me monetarily. But it is so much more than that. And I think that that is exactly what music waste is. It's like, we don't care about the money. We don't want that in our picture.
And in a city that is, objectively, as hostile to artists as Vancouver is, despite increasingly laughable attempts by people with no taste to cosplay as valuing art spaces, as long as they fit in a sanitized, bland, limited, and obscenely marketable view of what art is, not caring about money is strange, to say the least. I think there's this greater trend with pay artists being used as a kind of slogan, and there are big pros, of course, as well as big cons to that mentality. Natalie mentioned it earlier with the attitude that however much music waste has been able to pay bands in the past doesn't feel like much anymore. And it is true that artists' costs have gone up, and it's obviously true that everyone should be compensated for their work. But I do think it's a mistake to conflate compensation and payment. Music waste isn't around to pay bands as much as they possibly can, although, of course, it's a goal. But it's fundamentally by the community for the community. Compensation can look like appreciation, effort, care. And if bands aren't on board with that, then maybe they aren't a good fit for the festival. In my opinion, at least, it loses sight of the tenet of reciprocity that has been so central to the festival's mission for so long. I just think that pivoting towards a mentality where money becomes a focus is a dangerous game to play, especially when Music Waste's strength is that it has been able to operate without being tagged in for so long. And it's a game that often starts to come up when something's been around for a long time.
It's interesting. Things like this also run on, like, youth, you know, like younger energy, you know. I love it, you know. But it is funny. Yeah, that kind of, like, self-imposed self-exploitation, but that's also imposed by doing art in a city that doesn't really want it.
That youthful energy, or however Aaron said it, is so fundamental to all of the cultural shifts that Music Waste has gone through. Just thinking about how diametrically different people's perceptions of the festival are based on when they got to know it. It historically has not been the most welcoming space, despite the festival's efforts and maybe understandings of it being that at the time. But the cultural coldness of Vancouver makes opportunities for community that much more precious.
Oh, I definitely do. I feel like, okay, well, Vancouver's a very cold city. And there are a lot of pretentious music people out there in the world. And there are very few low barrier communities that promote inclusion and welcome people and integrate them like Music Waste does. And I also feel like Music Waste is so expansive, and it's one of the few, I shouldn't say few, I'm shading Vancouver way too hard, but Music Waste has a much better ethos than most. So it's like, this is perfect. And it's so big that, like, I got exposed to so, so, so many artists in the local scene in just the short time that I've been a part of it, so much quicker than I probably would have through any other organization, which was really cool. Yeah, just really great people, really great ethos.
I feel like that speaks to how clicky Vancouver is, or like the DJ scenes are. Like, yes, all the DJs know each other and are already friends, and like if you party then you can be in it too, but then otherwise, like, it's its own thing. And then same with like pop punk, or like same with whatever else, whatever other genre. So I think as someone who's lived in Vancouver their whole life, I've kind of been like exposed to so many different kind of spheres of the, like, sides of the art sphere. And yeah, it is way too segregated. I feel like people are like, oh, you're here? Oh, cool. I don't know. It's just like, I have like friends who, like, I'll be speaking about like other friends from like a different part of my life, and like I'll name drop all these people. I'm like, why don't you know them? And it just feels like, yeah, even though we're all in like East Van, or even if we're all queer or all artists, like there's way too many sectors, which is like, so I feel like something about living in Vancouver like repels us from each other, which is interesting because I feel like so many of the artists that were like musicians that we have on board, and like people we have on our committee and on our team, and like our volunteers as well, are all multidisciplinary artists, or like all have like different kinds of like outputs and expressions of self. And so it makes sense. I just think it's like the work that needs to be put in to like have it be in existence.
And as Music Waste and Art Waste work to provide community, accessibility, reciprocity, it can feel a bit like an oasis in the dank, wet night that is Vancouver's bizarre defensiveness, which is so important. But it is such a slippery slope to believe so strongly in a project, because that enmeshment of the organizer's identity and the mission of the event makes it more difficult for the event to change and grow.
I think I was resistant to like identifying with Music Waste, but it's such a community and I need it so much. Like I need it as much as like, I don't know, just like my friends, like y'all my friends. And I need it because Vancouver is so lonesome and so coded and weird that like having just like a very solid, reliable group of people that you can just bounce ideas off of is like really important. And I think it's like good to, it's like a little microcosm of like what we want for like the scene, right? So like we have a really like cool, low barrier, fun time organizing committee so that we could have like cool, low barrier, fun time hangouts with more people. I would like what I have with Music Waste to be like everyone has it, you know, because I feel like everyone is so lonely and everyone is so like, I want to connect with people and I want to work with people, and it just is too competitive or too, yeah, weird.
We are starving for connection out here, and Music Waste just offers the crumbs we crave.
Me personally, like, I don't mind making whatever sacrifices, time and all that, to get something done if it's for people I care about and for something that's cool. But I think also you kind of have to walk away at a certain time, you know, because not only do the year, but I feel like those things can eat away at you and you can start to feel, yeah, I don't know. I think it's just like trying not to personalize it too much, but you know, like I got it organized Comedy Waste this year. There's no going to be no comedy in the city. It's like, I don't know. That thought's coming from ego or something like that, maybe, like, and that martyrdom is, that stuff's interesting. And I think it happens a lot in like arts communities and volunteer communities too. Yeah, there's like people take a certain pleasure in how much pain it is causing them to collectively do something that will be cool. Yeah, I think I get off on it for like one day and then I completely wither. I know my limitations now. I think in 2017, I didn't know my limitations. I was like, yeah, I'll organize a festival. Sure. Yeah, I'll organize a festival. Easy. How many emails? 50? Fine. I love emails. I don't have a history of being terrible with emails at all. That's not something that's part of my life.
When I was talking to Sarah about her time on the festival, she was saying there was one year where she and Cameron Reed tried to do the entire festival by themselves because it was simpler than bringing more people on, which was obviously a disaster. But that is a part of the negotiation of putting things on as a volunteer. What is the path of least resistance? And it can feel like explaining yourself is a waste of time when you could be taking action. But when the alternative is complete burnout, then suddenly onboarding isn't such a bad idea.
Yeah, there can just be a lot of pressure, especially in like art scenes and nonprofits, which Music Waste isn't really a nonprofit, but it's got kind of somewhat of the spirit of that, you know, of like, we just like, you know, we like merge people's identities with these like organizations, which I think is just like a very human thing to do, but it's also just like not necessarily fair to the people running them, whether they're paid or not. And it, you know, it's like, I just felt like people started to see me like as Music Waste, and it's just like, oh, like I just want this festival to happen. Like, I don't, like, I'm not like one and the same with it, you know? So, I hope that the way that they do it now, maybe people don't have to feel that way, because I certainly felt a lot of pressure from that.
I mean, it is a really consuming thing. And I think that is part of the reason that I realized that it made sense for this to be my last year, because there's definitely been years where I've done just a ton of stuff and I wanted to do everything. I was like, I want to write the press release. I want to like make these graphics. I want to make this my whole life. And I feel like now I'm sort of at a point where it's like, oh yeah, I'm happy just doing like I love it. I love it so much. It feels really sad and weird, the idea that I will not be involved in the future. But I definitely have less enthusiasm for spending all of my free time on it, which I think is just like a sign that, you know, okay, time to end the era.
It's one of those things where it's like, it is a lot of work that you do have to put into it on a volunteer basis. And I think that it's worth it to a point. Like, it's worth it till it's not. And I think that's why there is turnover with organizers after a few years. And it's also why, like, we're so flexible with capacity. And if people need help, someone, it's so easy to ask to get someone to help.
Again, I want to point out how organizers from different eras' perspectives and relationships to music waste have changed so much. And like Eleanor said, it's so human to be invested and excited in something you're pouring so much of yourself into. But to go from feeling so much pressure to live up to something, to then feeling comfortable leaving when it's not serving you, to now encoding support for other organizers? Music waste is on a journey of treading the path of finding its boundaries and then learning to operate within them. Running Away to Montreal felt like this, produced by Void Puppet and Miguel Maravilla, the newest single by Danny Your Darling. Danny has been a staple in Vancouver's DIY scene for the past few years, making ambient, experimental R&B and collaborating with other artists in the city in a way that's really exciting to see. They've played Music Waste, Victory Square Block Party, Shindig, Fair Festival, Sound Therapy, and Unity Arts Collective's Floating Thoughts showcases, just to name a few. And audiences are obviously hungry for their singular sound and approach to performance. And unfortunately, it's not a sound that would have really fit into Music Waste's historic lineups.
The other way that it's evolved is that when I started going, it was definitely very like garage punk slash indie. Like, you know, all of the bands were, they weren't the same, but like they were of like a general kind of genre for the most part. And that's changed so much in a very like intentional way. There's been an idea that we do really want to diversify the type of music and performances that are happening at the festival. And I remember a very funny example of this was the first year we were like, we want to put on an electronic show. And there was like one person in the organizing committee who like really knew anything about electronic music. And we were just like, here, you tell us like which three electronic bands like sound good and we'll put that show on because like none of us knew anything, which is funny. And then I remember last year sort of like looking at the broader lineup being like, yeah, there's like three bands on this lineup that would have made sense in a 2012 MusicWiz lineup, you know? And I don't know, I think it's cool. Like, I think things in like DIY music in Vancouver have changed so much. And I'm really like, I think it's really cool that like MusicWiz has changed a lot too. But I think it's also interesting too, as like a lot of these spaces that have sort of been in the past more garage punk associated, like 8 years ago or something, spaces like Music Waste or even more established DIY venues like Redgate that used to sort of be more of what was programmed there as well. As these spaces have like shifted and intentionally tried to diversify their offerings too, I think, I don't know, I wonder if maybe that also creates more space for some of the genre and identity, for those like lines to become a little blurrier, and for like people to be like making like different types of music that they might have previously sort of felt excluded from that scene, or maybe they were intentionally excluded from that scene, but now that like things have opened up a bit in that way, in terms of like these established venues or festivals are like intentionally trying to program themselves differently, then yeah, the space just looks different, and hopefully like more different people feel welcome, and yeah, like they can make whatever kind of music that they want, you know?
Music Waste has made a very concerted effort to make sure that it's accessible to all artists. And there's an interesting conversation here about the relationship between genres and artists' identities. I've noticed that when people talk about diversifying their programming, they often use genre-focused language to imply identity. And it makes sense. For example, reggae is a genre that was innovated by Black musicians in a specific cultural and geographic area. So when festivals commit to intentionally programming more reggae acts, then you can hopefully assume that those acts are made up of Black artists. A person's cultural identity, in a lot of ways, is the foundation for their references, interests, and community, which in turn will absolutely influence the structures, themes, and tropes that build what genres are, that an artist will then be drawn to create. An issue comes up, though, with what are often considered basic genres, like rock, punk, or acoustic, which have been overwhelmingly dominated by white performers despite the invaluable contributions and innovations of racialized and indigenous artists, often since the genre's inception. But like Natalie was saying, as Music Waste sound transforms and they actively work to make the festival safer and more comfortable for everyone attending, then this interplay of genre and identity can also maybe start to break down the illusion that whitewashing has built around all types of music.
I think that this is a limitation almost set by Vancouver's demographics, but just having a little bit like more of an emphasis on diversity in the lineups and the artists that we choose. I do know that that's been something that we have pushed and that has been implemented to the best of our ability, but obviously we can't control like who applies and stuff. But yeah, it's so hard to balance not coming off as disingenuous or trying to fill a quota type deal. Like even like an open mic style night or something, because I know there's so many I have so many Black artist friends that don't have music released but are incredibly talented and perform stuff like couch jams all the time. And it's like, can we not pay them for that kind of thing? I feel like they deserve to be, you know? And there's so many great organizations in the city that, like, stuff like Couch Jams, where it's like, they already promote artists in this way. We should be platforming them instead of just trying to do what they're doing, but probably worse. So, like, more collaboration with, like, other orgs in the city.
But attempts to diversify the festival don't stop at programming. The organizing team itself has had to take really active steps to move away from the vice grip of whiteness in music.
Yeah. Well, because it is. It's super white. Like, it's been a super white festival. And, like, we struggled with that, too, you know, because often it's people with more privilege that have the freaking time to volunteer to do shit for free, right? Like, it's a privilege to have the time to volunteer to put on a festival. And, like, white privilege hugely contributes to that. So, yeah, it definitely is, like, I don't want to say it's a white festival, but, like, yeah, that has a lot of whiteness. I mean, but it's a Vancouver problem, as a CITR problem, as a Mint Records problem. Like, we have an issue with who is, like, in charge and leading things, you know? and who is taking up space, unfortunately.
And I feel a bit strange talking about this because obviously there are non-white people who have put the festival on and continue to put the festival on, and their contributions are essential. But it is just a fact that the majority of music waste's history has been dominated by overwhelming whiteness. And it's a problem that both Music Waste and Vancouver will both continually have to address. I don't want to move away from this topic lightly, but this idea of safety and accessibility just has so many different applications. For example, in nightlife, when people talk about building safer spaces, they're often referencing drug and alcohol use and gendered safety.
As well as just bringing in some more like kind of conscious safety interventions, which I think have just like evolved as well in a more general way, but like doing Narcan training for organizers, we've sometimes worked with Good Night Out or had people who have like bystander training and stuff at shows to intervene if anything happens, and making sure that we have opportunities for people to give feedback if any incidents do happen.
Either the second or third year I was involved, we also did like naloxone, like Narcan training for our volunteers, and tried to make our spaces feel a bit safer in that way. So that was great. I mean, it's not that I think they weren't safe before. I think, you know, we were just trying to reflect the changing nightlife landscape that was going on, you know, like, I don't think that these were things that were like glaringly missing from the years before, but it's just like things shift and change in arts and culture spaces all the time. And we're just trying to follow those things.
Safety conversations and trends are super affected by things that are happening in the broader culture.
I don't know. It feels so funny to be asked. Like, I feel like there's so many people who have contributed so much more than I. It felt very big in my life at the time, but like looking back, it was like a really short little blip, very special blip. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people who know a lot more about it than me. So. I don't know. I think I was just around at a pivotal time.
There are a lot of reasons why Eleanor's time at Music Waste was pivotal, but a massive event was the Me Too movement. She and I talked a lot about it off the record, but I was able to talk to Erin, who was putting on Comedy Waste at that time, for a little more context around how Music Waste as a festival was affected.
Yeah, I think after that, it also just like changed the perception of like, obviously so many things on a grand scale, but also like locally, you know, like there were so many predators in the Vancouver scene that, you know, did whatever, disappeared, went to the island, who knows. But yeah, it kind of put a dampness on stuff for a while, you know, like, and not in a bad way. I think that's like a consequence of, you know, realizing what kind of scene we were having that was allowing people to do that. I don't know if it affected the billing necessarily. Like, I definitely listened to like the Whisper Networks and all that stuff. So, you know, after, and I'm like aware of the people in the scene that are like, you know, doing weird shit. So I just don't book those people. But I have in the past. You don't know everything all the time. It's not like I have a perfect track record of not doing that. But so yeah, I don't know. It didn't like totally affect it, but definitely like I was very conscious of that, and the atmosphere of that was very, very much there. Yeah, and it shifted things in a really good way too. You know, like a lot of the predators went, and I see this, you know, I've been in the scene, the improv or stand-up scene and improv for 12 years now, and now it feels like a lot safer and stuff. You know, like there's way more women, there's like, there isn't this kind of like bro-y dome of silence, edge, weirdness. There's less of that. There's always going to be that, but it's harder to get away with it. So I was definitely thinking about that. I think it was on everyone's mind.
Me Too happened in 2016, and part of its impact was how it taught people to respond to allegations and safety concerns. Things that are now relatively commonplace, like zero tolerance policies and anonymous disclosure forms, hadn't been negotiated with the community yet. We just didn't have the language or the toolkit to compassionately address incidents as they came up, and we're trying to figure it out in real time. Which was overwhelming. Not quite the same, obviously, but I do think something similar happened in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd, with conversations around race and specifically blackness. But the effect of that was, unfortunately, overshadowed by the pandemic.
The pandemic just sort of like forced a lot of bands to change course a little bit too. Like, so all of these bands that like had been, you know, maybe performed at Music Waste a couple times already. A lot of those bands like just don't exist anymore. And a bunch of new bands sprang up, and people who were doing old projects like are doing different things now. Some of them aren't making music at all. Like some of them are, yeah, doing something completely different. And yeah, I mean, there's like so many bands now. And it just feels like, I don't know, I am continuously shocked and humbled by how many bands want to apply to Music Waste. It was hard to know what it would look like. Like the 2022 festival, I think, which was our first year back doing an in-person festival, the number of bands that applied was definitely a little smaller. And I don't know, it was hard to say like, oh, okay, does that mean that like we're less relevant? Is there just like less going on right now? Are people unsure about doing a live thing? Like you never know why you get less applications. But then this year we had 55 applications in the first 48 hours. Like that's wild. So we're back, baby.
COVID completely transformed Vancouver's music scene. And like Me Too, it produced a new normal. But these shifts weren't explicitly around identity or oppression, but more around labor, capacity, and care. This is Time Not Wasted, a radio documentary looking back at 30 years of Music Waste Festival. Part 2, The Secret Unconscious Punk Desire. You just heard Deny by Cascadia off their 2013 Level Trust EP. We've been talking a lot about Music Waste changes, transformations, etc. And I cannot overstate how essential they were to the festival even continuing.
Yeah, I think if Music Waste had continued to like do the one day listening party and like only bring in people that already knew people, it would have stopped. You know, there would have been call outs or call ins or however you want to describe that. There already was that happening, which is, I think, always a good thing. And like, it just would have kind of stagnated and it would have been more of the same bands playing all the time. And I'm not sure that it would have continued to last. So it's kind of like adapt or die.
I've never been a part of a music space that's been so fluid, especially and so reactive, and proactive regarding things surrounding its ethos, which is great. It's pretty awesome. There's so much room, obviously, to shape things for the better and such, but in the short time that I have been a part of it, it's been great in that sense, which I appreciate.
I think there's an interesting conversation here about relevance and whatever that means. Because Music Waste is proactive, it set a precedent for being at the forefront of a lot of conversations around culture and safety. And there's a kind of funny evaluation of what serves the festival. Obviously, there's the programming and the art and the community aspects of it, but there's also vibes and traditions.
Yeah, it's funny that you brought up the shotgun thing. I was like, just in the last couple of days, like thinking about talking to you for this, I was just thinking a little bit about like how things have changed over the year. And I was like, yeah, definitely like the kicking off the festival by like shotgunning in the alley is not, yeah, that's probably never going to happen again. Not because of some like specific reason that it shouldn't, but just because if no one carries it forward, which would probably at this point be me, then nobody knows that it exists and like why would it happen? But I think there's also like lots of good reasons that it like doesn't necessarily make sense as the way to kick things off.
So why does this festival continue? What is the reason?
Something that, and I can't remember who, but it was somebody who I was either working on it with, who was older than me and had done it a bit longer, or like someone in the community. I remember expressing stress once that like if I stopped doing it, you know, just like the guilt you feel when you move on from something, who will do this after me? Like what, you know, you feel this sense of responsibility. And they were like, the great thing about Music Waste is that as long as people think it should happen, it will. And when people no longer kind of think it needs to happen or like believe that it's relevant anymore, it will stop happening because it's run entirely by volunteers. And I think that that's just like a really beautiful thing. And when I reflect back on that time, I think when you have people that want to make something happen, even if there's like a lot of odds against it, or if it's like, it seems like an insurmountable amount of like work and coordination, it's totally possible if you have people who are excited about it and want to do it. Like, it's amazing to me that I helped to put on an event like entirely run by volunteers that had over 80 bands and was over 4 days, and that we were able to pay people a small amount, but still like play the musicians and sell out of passes, like out of nothing, really. Like that's, you know, and that just speaks to the fact that like people saw value in it and wanted to make sure that it continued to happen and pulled together to do it. And that's just very, it's just very cool.
It still continues to be, like, as I sort of described before, I think just one of the best things in Vancouver. And I think largely as a result of, honestly, like real estate prices, among other factors, there's just not as much space for non-profitable cultural things to happen in the city. And somehow, maybe because of the lack of like formal mid-sized venues, Vancouver's sort of always like maybe punched above its weight in terms of the DIY scene, for lack of a better term. And so I think like having this like one sort of beautiful nonprofit festival that is like co-created by all of the people that are involved and like influenced by what the audience thinks and influenced by how the bands feel about it, but not at all influenced by having to make money, I think is really beautiful and important.
I think the thing that's cool about that, and especially with like the music industry and so many industries just like absolutely plummeting because of, you know, whatever, everything and corporations and all that, like is a return to the value of art and comedy and performance on like a localized level, you know, like pre-internet or whatever, like you got these comedians in town, you got these bands in town, and you go see them and that's your entertainment and it's really exciting, especially seeing it live. So I think it's like doing the thing that art and music and that is supposed to do, which is like have artists in your city making stuff and music that you can enjoy. And I think it's just there to also like show the city that there's tons of stuff happening, and like it's just exciting. I think it's exciting for a bunch of musicians and stuff to have 3 days where it's like you're seeing concerts and then you're seeing each other out, and then you're like, oh, you're going to this show, you know, it's like going back to that, like what art is mostly for. It's for like the people in your town so you can go see it. Yeah, I think people are still hungry for that. And I think, I don't know. I wonder why it hasn't died. I think there is kind of like down here, I think there is kind of like a secret disdain for everything trying to come at art. I think like no matter how weird, it's funny talking to me, you're like, oh, I have a complicated relationship with this town, with Vancouver. But as much as it is like, as much as it's a weird town that is kind of cold and cool, like everyone still unconsciously has this desperate desire for there to still be art and music in this town. And going to music shows is so sick, you know? So I think it hasn't died because I think there's like this secret unconscious punk desire to make sure that there's still art here. And I think that's cool.
You heard it here first. What else can we say other than it's this secret unconscious punk desire? And that's pretty cool. Thank you so much for tuning in to Time Not Wasted, a radio documentary looking back at 30 years of Music Waste Festival. This was part two, this secret unconscious punk desire. In this episode, we went over the more recent history of Music Waste Festival, where it's at now, the changes it's made in the past few years, and how those changes came to be. Check out part one, Hallelujah to That, on CITR.ca to hear the full documentary. Music Waste Festival starts this week. It runs from June 6th to 9th at venues all over East Vancouver. Go to musicwaste.ca to see the full lineup, get a festival pass, and check out the festival schedule. I want to give a huge thank you to all of the amazing volunteers, acquaintances, friends, and angels that I had the privilege of speaking with for this documentary. Dustin Bromley, Natalie Corbo, Sarah Cordingley, Naomi Endale, Duncan McHugh, Lori Mercer, Chris Mitchell, Aaron Charles Reed, Eleanor Wearing, and Lee Young. Thank you for sharing your insight with me, and I feel so, so lucky to consolidate these stories. Thanks, Kiara Reed, for your generous editorial guidance. And last, but certainly not least, thank you, Music Waste Festival. This episode was written and produced by me, Dora Duber. The music used was Cool TV's Green, Channel 3 and 4, Blackbird, Danny Your Darling, Running Away to Montreal Felt Like This, produced by Void Puppet and Miguel Maravilla, Masink, Once More with Feeling, Cascadia, Deny, and Dumb Mint. All music featured in this episode can be found in CITR's music library. Sign of our good friend.